Today I'm here in Seddon, and I'm at a very nice little cafe in Seddon that looks like it's just dropped in from New York, really, and I'm very lucky to be talking to Josephine Rowe. For the listeners who perhaps don't know Josephine, she's a poet and a fiction writer, and her work's appeared in various magazines, Meanjin, Overland, Best Australian Stories, Best Australian Poems, the IR Review and the Griffith Review. And I believe they've also been reinterpreted as short films, performance pieces, and broadcast on radio. Her first collection of short stories, When a Moth Becomes a Boat, was published in 2009, and now Tarkata Wake is her recent collection of short stories. So very nice to meet up with you at last, Josephine.
You as well. Thanks for having me.
Now, I believe you're just back from the Adelaide Writers' Week, and you were presented there as part of the next generation of young writers and one of Australia's exciting new talents. So perhaps you can just say a little bit about how Adelaide was for you. I'm also interested, I suppose, in, as one of the exciting new talents and young writers, how your approach differs to older writers.
How
your approach differs to older writers?
How my approach differs to older writers?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, firstly, on your question of the Adelaide Writers Festival, it was very beautiful. It's a very kind of beautifully set up festival. It would have been lovely to stay there for longer. Unfortunately, I felt a little bit rushed because it was a bit of a fly-in, fly-out, 24-hour sort of affair. As to the panel of the next generation, I don't think any of us felt particularly comfortable in that role.
Label.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's something that you can only measure retrospectively, suppose, you know.
Yes. So I suppose the Writers' Festival people have to sort of put people together in some sort of collection, don't they? So come up with some sort of a label that perhaps tries to cover what those people have got in common. It's sort of a marketing sort of approach, I suppose, isn't it?
Well, that panel was specific to poetry as well, which of course I do write,
but
I probably don't identify as being purely a poet as such, and I don't know that I would make the best ambassador for young Australian poets just now.
Well, let's talk about your stories. They're what captured my attention. And I was thinking about them and thinking, your stories for me are like opening the door to a room and looking in briefly and then shutting the door and going away and being left with just a few impressions.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know when to enter and leave that story room? For example, your first story in your Tarkata collection, Brisbane, starts off with an "and," as if some of that first part of the story has just been deleted. So how do you know that sort of coming in and when to come in and when to go out of a story?
Oh, well, I think it generally depends on the story, but that thing of coming into the middle of things, you know, I didn't even know the term in media res until I'd been utilising it for some years. It just seemed quite natural to me that you would that you would hit the ground running, you know, get past the small talk and the introductions, and how important is it that we know what these people look like, or how important is it that we know what their names are, or what gender they are, or what age they are, where is the core of the story. So it really does differ depending on the piece. Not all stories have to serve the same function. Not all stories have to serve a function apart from to entertain or to move.
I suppose that's what is true, really, because you've got some very brief stories in the collection, but some quite long stories too. For example, the story Cotton is only 10 lines, and then there's the other story, Treacherous, is only 5 lines. So they're very, very short. But then there's another longer story, Raising the Wreck, which is really more the length of a conventional short story.
Yeah, that's something that I have. I wrote Raising the Wreck towards the end of putting the collection together. So the longer stories in the collection, Raising the Wreck, the title story, Tarkata Wake, and a story called All You Really Have to Do Is Be Here, were the three last pieces that I wrote. And I suppose that happened fairly organically. I became more interested in place towards the end of writing the collection. And I think part of that was I was living in a hotel room in Iowa City. I was very far away from home, and whereas a lot of my stories, you mentioned before, walking into a room and then shutting the door, it's almost quite literal because they're very they tend to be very interior. A lot of them are placeless or in very transient places, like hotel rooms and motel rooms and houses between houses and that sort of thing.
They could be anywhere in
precisely,
the world, really.
Yes. And the characters are nameless and genderless and, you know, often of no specified age. So that was kind of, for me, a means of allowing the reader, I suppose, any reader, to kind of step into that space and perhaps inhabit it.
Yes.
But towards the end of the collection, I think because I was so far away from home and because I was in this strange, transient place of living in a hotel for 3 months, I just started writing a lot about Australia. And it was much more, the stories were much more grounded in particular geographies as well, you know, like rural New South Wales or St. Kilda or...
Yes.
You know, the Gold Coast for Raising the Wreck. And maybe it's because of having that kind of anchor that there was room for the rest of the story to kind of develop.
I hadn't thought about what you said, but I sort of understand it. But now I was going to ask later that most locations in the stories appear sort of more generic rather than specific. But I guess that's a real strength, isn't it? Because they can be read anywhere, you know, they can be read by in any part of the world, really, and people are not sort of put off by having to know that location or things specific to that location.
Yeah.
Whereas they say, you know, in storytelling, you should always think about location and be specific and, you know, really rooted in a particular location.
Yeah, well, I think the thing about, you know, what they say is you really can take or leave what they say. You don't have to be staring at a poster of Freytag's pyramid every time you you go to set out the structure of your story. You let that be, I guess, that follows on from the kind of raw materials you're working with at the start, whether that, that is a character or whether it's a theme or, or an event, that whatever the kind of kernel is that sparks the story.
And I was going to ask you about that, just to sort of jump in, because thinking particularly, thinking about that 10-line story, Cotton, I was just sort of intrigued to know the origin of how it sort of came about, and I suppose more generally, what's the jumping-off point for some of the stories? I mean, are they experiences, conversations heard, situations? Where do they... I'm not supposed to ask you about where stories come from, but,
okay.
You know, that sort of jumping, that origin thing, I think is really interesting.
That specific question is very, it's very interesting, especially when you're talking about stories that are kind of, you said, generic. I would say maybe unfixed, I suppose. They kind of
rudderless.
let's go with that. Rudderless, I like that. I think Cotton's a very good example of how that can be applicable to things later on. It started, I believe, sometimes it's not very easy to pinpoint where a particular story starts, and sometimes you really do just hear a line. Somebody was, a friend of mine's at NYU this year, and he was talking about the girls at NYU who come from money, and you can tell they come from money because their hair is always incredibly clean. And it's just never something that's occurred to me to kind of like think of class in that way.
Clean
I know
hair.
A lot of people with not a great deal of money who have fantastic hair.
That's right.
But that was, so I guess that was kind of the jumping off point for that, that little vignette, I guess you could say. But shortly after, the book was published, after Takara Wake was published, there was the Jill Maher tragedy.
Of course, yes.
And so I don't think anybody at that point who, you know, the book was maybe a couple of months old, I don't think anybody who picked it up and read that story and knew about Jill Maher could not kind of draw that line. So I couldn't read it live at the time because it changed shape for me as well.
I don't know whether I'm sort of pushing this, you know, idea of how stories come about too much, but it seemed to me that some of your stories are just really a series of clues, and you make us imagine the rest, you know. You make us work, we the reader. We have to sort of do a lot of work and imagining to fill in those gaps and put the clues together.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's great. I really like that, because I hate hate. I don't like the stories that sort of spell everything out and tie everything up neatly, because there's nothing left and there's nowhere for you to go as the reader. But you give us somewhere to go. You push us in a direction and make us sort of think about them.
I think the hope is that we're, with those stories that you say are kind of an assembly of clues, is that everybody will read them slightly differently. Mm. It's like, I've likened it to photography before. If you're viewing a photograph, you are probably imagining what is outside of the frame very differently to what your friend or your fellow viewer is imagining.
Yes.
So I guess I wanted them to be more like, I suppose, theatre, in that they, you know, you'll never see the same piece of theatre that, a piece of theatre that is exactly the same from night to night. So it's got that ability to be, I guess, unfixed and rudderless.
Yes, yeah.
Sorry, I've forgotten where you started your question.
Well, no, I was calling the stories just a series of clues. And
sure, you, okay, yes. I was going to say is, as far as, it's a lot of buses, I'm sorry. I guess, in terms of not over-explaining or not dumbing things down, the way I work is to kind of pare things back and re-edit and re-edit and re-edit. I work at a fairly glacial pace in that sense, that things will kind of slowly build up and then I'll tear them down again. And I'm a fairly fragmented writer, irregardless of what form I'm working in, if it's poetry, fiction, even non-fiction, or reviews or things like that, I'll still apply a fairly similar methodology of building things up in a fragmentary sense and then kind of, I guess, assembling those pieces and smoothing down the edges. Mm. So anything that doesn't really hold up to scrutiny, anything that I see as being unnecessary or perhaps not doing the same amount of work as the following and preceding line, I will just remove.
Yeah. So you do a lot of search and destroy by the sound of it for your work. Yeah, yeah. I read, I think it was last Saturday in The Age, there was a piece where writers were asked to talk about the influences on their writing. And you mentioned Heart is the Lonely Hunter and the character Mick in that story. Can you say something perhaps a bit about that?
Oh, sure. We were asked about our literary or fictional heroines.
Yes.
And I said yes straight away, because of course. And then you think about it for a while and you're like, okay, who do I find inspirational, the most inspirational out of all of your filmic and fictional female characters? And I just love Mick Kelly's enthusiasm and heart, and she's got a bit of a spiky, discontented streak, but it's because she sees this, she's just beginning to understand the great unfairnesses of the world and kind of responding to them with this kind of directionless rage, but she's got a lot of heart.
I've mentioned at the beginning that you've had two collections of short stories published. I came to your Tarkata Wake before I came to How a Moth Becomes a Boat. I was just wondering, what do you think the differences between the two collections for you? Like, there's about 3-4 years or 3 years in between. Do you think they've changed or evolved in any way?
Well, I think it's certainly changed. I'd like to think that it's evolved
better
a little bit. I'd like to think that. There's probably about 4 years between the two collections. Typically, the stories in Tarkata are both longer and shorter.
Yes, they are. Yes.
Aside from that, I think, I suppose Tarkata was a different process in terms of compiling a book, because I had a central theme that I wanted to work with that kind of sprung up organically amongst the first few stories that I wrote for the collection, which kind of all corresponded to relics in some way or another. Mm. So developing on that was, I guess I felt I had a clearer direction.
So you don't just sort of look at the stories you've got and then think perhaps what connects all these stories in order to put together a collection? Or you don't, you obviously wouldn't say you start with a theme and then let's write, you know, some stories that fit that theme. You don't sound like that sort of writer.
Well,
or the themes in your unconscious anyway, or the interests.
For this, I think you ideally want actually, I don't know what's ideal, whether or not in compiling a short story you do want there to be a linking theme or a kind of, you want there to be conversation with each of the pieces. What that conversation is about is kind of up to the writer, really. I found it was good to kind of have that kind of recurring idea of relics, whether they be you know, something concrete like souvenirs or something more transient like memory or inherited beliefs or traditions or that sort of thing, and to approach that same idea from a number of different angles. I guess it just, I'd like to think all of the responses to that kind of central idea were very different and probably unavoidably nostalgic because I'm a fairly nostalgic person, but did work at kind of keeping that to a minimum.
Just on a slightly different tack then, I noticed in 2011 you did attend the University of Iowa's International Writing Program, and I'm wondering how that experience influenced your writing.
Well, as I mentioned, you know, living in the hotel room for 3 months, that I wrote a lot more about, a lot more about Australia. I was there with about 36, I believe, international writers. So, I mean, that experience in itself was phenomenal, and they were all older than me and probably more established than me in most cases. So I felt a little bit intimidated for about 5 minutes, and then everybody just kind of, you know, we mostly got along really well. Of course, 3 months living in each other's pockets, there was a few little a few little explosive moments between some people, but most of us emerged as pretty good friends. And I definitely got a better idea of I guess unfairness in other parts of the world, people had been prosecuted because of what they had written, and came away feeling that I had a better sense of the literary world. I guess there were specific kind of opportunities that came out of that. Myself, the Singaporean playwright Jeremy Chang, and the Colombian novelist and short fiction writer Pilar Quintana went over to Maine to work with the theatre company, and that was very interesting because it was essentially staged readings, but I was writing in the mornings. We would sometimes hear him singing at that time, and that was the piece they were working with, a kind of early version of that, and it kind of enabled me to think a little bit differently about dialogue and that sort of thing. Hearing a group of strangers reading your work will always do that. Very, very different kind of experiences came out of that.
Sounds like a very opening, a very broad.
Definitely. I met up with Alice Pung beforehand because she had gone over in 2009, and we were having coffee with them. The cultural affairs officer from the Melbourne consulate, US consulate, and Alice said, you know, it was a life-changing experience, and I kind of thought, wow, well, that sounds incredible, but then you kind of think, well, Alice is a very open, very warm person, I can be a little bit reserved, perhaps my experiences will not be the same as hers, but it was life-changing.
Probably one of my last questions is, you've been described as being interested in marginalised characters. Do you know why that might be, or is that just a personal, is that a political sort of outlook, or why do you think that is? Or are they just more interesting to write about? More flawed, more
everybody's
on the edge.
Flawed.
Yeah.
I think a lot of writers come to writing, being fairly having having maybe grown up or experienced times of feeling outside of things, of feeling more of an observer than a participator. So simply out of that,
Okay. Just finally then, I wondered whether I could get you to do a little bit of a reading for us,
Sure, my pleasure.
If you'd like to choose something
from
Tara
Cover. Do you have a shorter story that you would like to hear?
Look, if you want to just choose a short piece that seems appropriate for the day, for the traffic noises and the cafe ambiance.
Something about cars, actually.
We are listeners dealing with traffic here in Seddon, lots of traffic going up and down, but I hope that gives you a bit of an idea of the atmosphere that we're sitting in at the moment.
Right near the trucking routes. I'll lean in close. Actually, I'll just read Brisbane.
Okay,
it's got a bit
great.
A bit of traffic in it, a bit of travel. And she had this way of swiveling her head round, like an owl, to talk to you as she drove. Except not like an owl, because the skin of her neck creased up in folds, and she looked so old when that happened. Though she wasn't, not then. And Luke would lean over and say, "Watch the road, Mum." And what I'll remember of this time is split vinyl and continental breakfasts. Fights about who gets the passenger seat, a wallaby cracked over the head with the jack handle, and none of us talking till Lismore, even though we know she's done the right thing. We pull in silent to the motel, a low sandy brick L shape, with all the doors facing onto the car park, and the car park mostly empty, mostly dark. Our room is number 17, and there is a TV that only gets two stations, and one double bed, which my brother and I fall into fully clothed with only our shoes kicked off. But something wakes me a few hours later and I panic, forgetting where I am. I go over to the window on shaky legs and see her from the back, standing out by the road. A blonde in denim pedal pushers and white tennis shoes, standing in the light of the motel sign like the ghost of 1967. Ghost of her younger self, holding a slim beer bottle down by her hip, fingers round its throat like she wants to swing it at something. In the dark of the room I find the bar fridge, take a bottle of cola from inside the door. Luke lifts his head from the pillow and says, "Ali, don't you drink that. Those cost like four times as much as they do in the shops," and I say, "Shut up, I'm not going to." And I go back to the window. Try to stand the way she does, the bottle dangling loose from my fingertips, like I don't care if I drop it, like I don't care about anything. She stands like that for a long time, just looking out at the road like she's waiting for someone to come pick her up. In the morning, there are flecks of rust-coloured hair dye in the bathroom sink, and Luke takes one look at her and says, "That's not going to change anything, Mum," because he's older and sharper than I am, but he still gets a slap for it. So we're all silent in the car again, all morning, and I wish the radio still worked. "When we get to Brisbane," she's telling us, "you won't even remember." And I don't know if she's talking about Dad, or the slap, or the wallaby, or Victoria, or that she was ever a blonde. But in any case, I know she's lying, because she's got her lips pressed into a pale line and her eyes fixed hard on the road.
Jocelyn, thank you very much for that reading of Brisbane, which is the first story in your latest collection, Tarkata Wake. As you were reading, it just occurred to me, I was thinking about other writers in Victoria, Romy Ash and Tony Birch.
Sure. So
there's a bit of that sort of interplay there too in some of their more recent work. Like a bit of a preoccupation with... Romy, I'm sorry, I forget your latest...
It's called
story.
Floundering.
Floundering,
Romy,
that's
Ashes.
Right. Yeah,
yeah, I guess the children observing parents and the unknowableness of parents as well.
Mm.
I think we all go through stages of writing that.
The wisdom of children,
They
know more than their parents.
Mm-hmm.
They're a lot wiser.
Yep.
Yeah.
Again, it's that kind of observational
kind of...
almost reportage without without an articulated investigation of that.
Yes, yeah. Look, I'm going into more questions and I'm sorry for that, but I just want to thank you very much, Josephine. You're sitting here on a very hot morning in Sedden. Thank you for giving us the time, and I look forward to reading the rest of your work.
It's my pleasure, John. Thank you so much.
And there's a bus going by just to prove we were actually on location. Thank you.